right. We're here with Daphne Suman, author of The Silence of Scheherazade. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yep, correct.
Awesome. It is out now. It's almost a month since the release date. And this is your first English translation book, correct?
Okay, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah.
Very exciting. Thank you so much, Daphne, for joining us. I will, you know, forgive me. I've still got about 100 pages left to read. And I'm like,
no worries. I know.
It's about to go down.
All right. Good. You're kind of at the end of it. The last bit is easiest.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm finding that. Yeah. It's like the pace is definitely like picked up and, you know, cause yeah, like the first three quarters of the book, you're setting the stage. We're getting to know the characters, the backstory, the families, and like kind of a little bit of the history too, and how it's like affecting these different groups of people. Yeah. Before we get started, how about you give like maybe a brief little summary of the book?
Of course, listeners
can kind of follow along with the conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I would love to do that. And thanks for having me in your show. I'm really, really honored to be here. So The Silence of Scheherazade is a historical fiction. It's taking place in the Ottoman Empire at the beginning of 20th century, at the end of the First World War, actually. Like the most of the book is taking place in between 1919 and 1922, and it's a crucial time for Ottoman Empire, where the empire actually disappears, and what's today the countries in the Balkan region and the Republic of Turkey comes out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. And I picked one of the very rich, very famous cities of Ottoman Empire, that is called Smyrna. So I picked that as the metaphor of the whole entire empire. And it wasn't just coincidence, or it wasn't because the city is beautiful, was beautiful, because it's actually a very perfect metaphor for the empire, where everybody, like seven different languages and different four different religious groups, different ethnicities live together harmoniously. And the end of empire meant the end of the cosmopolitan life in Smyrna. And so mainly that's what I wanted to tell. And for this, I needed to pick four women from four different ethnicities, but all of them citizens of town Smyrna, and of course, citizens of Ottoman Empire. And so I picked one Turkish woman, Sümbül, one Greek young woman, Panayota, one from the Catholic French descendants of Ottoman citizens called Levantines, and Edith Lamarck, a French Ottoman citizen, and one Armenian midwife. So I wanted to bring this story together in a way these four women are mixed in a way that they don't know. And by the time the book is over, their relationship is revealed, but the life, the space they live, which is Smyrna, has disappeared into ashes. And what's today known as Izmir, the modern, one of the most modern cities of Turkey, appears, but there's no more of those women or the cosmopolitan life that they lived in Smyrna. So in a nutshell, this is our story, the end of Smyrna. In order to give the end, we have to construct it with all the details. And that's what I try to do, introduce the character, introduce their lives, their neighborhoods, their homes, their families, a typical everyday life of a woman of back then. So that's how we begin. And once we get to know them, we start to understand the connections. Because at the beginning, it sounds like they're not related. And many people ask me, what is going on? Like, we jumped from, you know, one Turkish neighborhood, and then we moved to this Greek neighborhood. And who is this, like, French people living in Smyrna?
Yeah.
So you have to be patient. And it's a 500-page book. It's like I tried to write an epic, I guess.
Yeah, I know. Like, kind of how I said before, it was like, I like the word patient, because it's like, obviously it's all very like, you know, part of the storytelling and part of the world building. So I like historical fiction. I find some of it really fascinating, and especially like all the research that was probably involved and whatever. And so, you know, the fact that you chose to intertwine or to tell this story, like, of this. It was obviously a significant point in history, but there are, like, all these stories from these types of communities and how within a few years it could all just be switched up on upside down. And, you know, and here, like, listening and reading the point of views from these different groups, it's just, it's so interesting to kind of, like, you know, they're living their day-to-day lives and they're, like, affected by these things because they're young women growing up in these times. But also then there's this, like, huge overarching, like, conflict that they're not all totally aware about the seriousness until it's, like, it's too late.
Exactly. And that's what I, you know, it's fun to write historical fiction. I like reading historical fiction. But besides, I really want to tell the story of today. Mm-hmm, I didn't want to talk about history. I didn't want to, you know, the point is not to enjoy historical fiction. Okay, you, as a side effect, you can enjoy historical fiction. But the whole story is the story of today. What's happening at the early 20th century is actually the dates are matching too, right? Because I said that most of the story is taking place between 1919 and 1922. We are right now in 2021. Yeah. So we are in that times. And early 20th century is shockingly, surprisingly, very similar to early 21st century, where everything is about to dissolve. The way we know world is about to dissolve. The borders are disappearing. Nation states, they don't mean anything anymore. You see, you know, we are on Zoom. You're in the United States. I'm in Turkey. And who cares? We're all speaking English. So things are really, really changing in the world. And there's probably a war. I mean, not probably. There is a war. There is war everywhere in the world, except like small corners where we are very lucky. And we know it's like right here, right, like I'm showing right next to my head, over my shoulder, that something is coming and our lives could be upside down at any given moment. So this was actually what I was trying to tell, this story of us. And like in my book, in the story of the Silence of Scheherazade, people are like, the war is really at the door. Literally, it's right at the border of the city. And people are still choosing to ignore. And it must be like around the pages you are right now towards the end.
A little
they're
bit,
still having, they're still having beer. They're still having, you know, fish and chips and talking about like how delicious the food. Oh, the war over there is so painful. Poor refugees. And they go on and on and on, like the way we do, never thinking that next day, and literally the next day, it's them who are trying to flee from a city that's burning. And they are in the boats and they're trying to row as fast as possible to get away from the ashes, from the fire, from the flames.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a story of today. I only use the time as a metaphor to, because it's a good symbol for today.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, when it comes to like historical fiction, I feel like, or maybe I haven't looked enough for it, but I feel like there's not a whole lot out there for that time period that you're choosing, or at least maybe not written in English. I don't know. And because there are so many like conflicts in other parts of the world. And so, you know, I'm glad that, you know, you decided to also make this available in English. So there's a couple things I want to touch on. So like, I kind of previously mentioned like the research that like it was involved. So can you talk about that? Like what you did to like, you know, prepare for like the historical facts and all that? And like maybe what were some of like the most fascinating things you learned while researching for the book?
Well, research was so much fun. I actually, I met a lot of people. There are some Smyrna crazy people in the world. That was the most interesting thing for me to learn. Like some people in the world, and it's so amazing to meet with these, they're obsessed about the history of Smyrna. Like this little, like relatively small town in a place called Ottoman Empire. And they're obsessed about that. So they're collecting everything, the maps, the houses, who owned what house, what burned in the fire. Meeting these Smyrna crazy people was fun. So I did the research in three different countries. When I was writing this book, I was living in Oregon, in Portland. I lived in Portland for 10 years, and I was writing the book in Portland, which is like far from Smyrna, far from Greece, far from Athens, everywhere. Then I went to Smyrna, I went to Izmir, and I went to Athens. So I had like three places where I was doing my research. United States was so good with the library system, I was able to get every book I wanted.
Oh, awesome.
I went to New York at the library of NYU. I actually looked at the newspapers from the 1922 with the microfilm. So I read all the newspapers, looked at the photos. Then I went to Athens because many of the Greek communities of Smyrna moved to Athens, and they have a museum of Smyrna. And there I found like school books of children, school clothes of children, plates and forks and silverware, all like brought from Smyrna to Athens. So I saw those. And then one last stop, I went to Izmir itself, to the space. And of course, Smyrna at the end of the book, and it's a historical fact that the city burns right down to ashes. There is nothing remaining from the old Ottoman Smyrna, and a modern city named Izmir is built on top of the ashes. But there is still some very, very tiny milestones that I was able to find. So I was measuring steps, like how long does it take to walk from one point to the other,
right,
from the train
right
station to the sea. Those were still remaining. And then that was the third leg of my research, really being in the space and trying to find history where the history was erased completely.
Mm.
That was my research. And it was really fulfilling experience for me researching.
Yeah, I bet. That's so cool. That's crazy that you lived in Portland. And now, so how, and you're in Turkey now, how long ago did you move to Turkey? And like, why were you, have you just been kind of a person who lives like all over the world at certain parts in your life?
I'm kind of like that. I lived in Portland for 10 years between 2005 and 2015. And then I kind of continue living in Portland. Like I there and, you know, a lot of friends. I live there. I met my husband in Portland. So we actually have a condominium. We own a condominium there. So we have a lot of connection to Oregon.
Nice.
But I am from Turkey and I write in Turkish. So once I actually started writing and my books are getting more and more popular in Turkey, I wanted to be closer to the Turkish speaking audience. And now things are turning the other way. Now the books are being translated to English and I'm thinking maybe we should go back to Portland and be closer to the English speaking world. So yes, I'm fluid. I don't like to settle in one place. I'm ready to move like this. You tell me, let's move and I go.
I love it. No, I like traveling and I wish I was able to use my passport a little bit more, but so far I've traveled enough, I think, for the time being. But no, and I've been to Portland once before too, because I'm actually closer to Chicago. I've been to Portland and I was really cool. I really enjoyed the time there too. So like I could see how you would get very comfortable there and like, you know, just enjoy everything that city had to offer.
I know. Absolutely.
I love like that you got so into the research and that you also visited the locations and that you were able to like, you know, be physically there and, you know, to have that accuracy of like
I counted
the spatial
steps,
awareness.
I'm telling you, I got a little obsessive, like later in my books, I wasn't that obsessive, but with that one, I really got obsessive and I there is a final scene where Panayota is running from the graveyard to the sea. I actually did run just to time it how long it takes to run from.
Oh, wow.
It was summer, it was hot. And I was like, you know, I wasn't a 17-year-old girl like Panayota.
Right.
I was 37 and I ran there.
The things you do for the research, right?
Exactly. The things I do for the research. Crazy.
That's awesome. So what were like, so I know like this is probably a much different experience releasing this and plus the English version, the English translation compared to your other work. So like let's talk about like how like your experience with releasing this one differed from previous things that you've published.
you know, having a book translated to English, it's a huge success for any international writer.
Sure.
This is one thing we always look forward to, because, you know, when, if you are a Turkish writer, if you are writing in Turkish, it's relatively easy to have your works translated in your neighbor countries, like in Greece.
Sure.
My books were published in Greece almost immediately. They were released in Turkey. Then same in Armenia, in the Balkans, in Bulgaria, that's easy. But the more, you know, you go west to Germany, to France, to England, then to the United States and Canada, it becomes harder and harder, because the competition is really hard. And I read English books a lot, but there's a fact. I don't read translated fiction in English. If I'm going to pick a book in English, I pick usually a book that is written in English. So translated market is a very difficult one. But I really wanted to be part of it, mostly because my friends in Portland, they always ask me, when are we going to read your books? When are we going to read your books? I hired a translator one day. I was like, okay, you guys will read my books. So here's what I'm going to do. I have found a translator, an American lady who lives in Turkey, and she lived in Turkey since 1960s. She speaks excellent Turkish, and she's a great fan of literature, and she's a very good translator. So we started working with her. I paid out of pocket. I said, let's translate these books. I don't know if I'm going to find a publisher, but I'm going to take the first step, regardless if I have a publisher or not. And soon after that, I got an offer from a very good publisher in the UK. And they said, we want to publish this, Silence of Shehrazad. And another one of my books is coming around the breakfast table next year. So, I took the initiative. I didn't wait for a publisher to find me. I said, I'll do this and I'll go with that.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And I bet it paid off. You know, because sometimes that's just what you have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a good intuition. And otherwise, you know, for a long time, I said, you know, if my books are really good, somebody will find them someday. That's not true. If your books are not in English, nobody will find you, because nobody will know what your books are about.
Yeah. Or, you know, the bubble is a little bit smaller if it's not in English. Like, people will discover it, but it's not, you know, you want to branch out. You want to get out there. Yeah,
exactly. Sure. Yeah. And for the translation, because I speak English, I actually read every chapter. Like, my translation sent me every chapter.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that, if you read your book in English.
Yeah, I read it in, like, every chapter, and I corrected certain things. You know, some parts of the book, you know, they're Greek. It's a Greek culture. Some of them are, like, and it's old, you know, old Turkish. Most of the text was written with the old Turkish. So I needed to interfere a little bit, but she did an amazing work. So we finished it together.
Yeah. So how long did that take her then to, like, translate the entire book, or for both of you to work on that?
She was so quick.
Oh, wow.
She was so fast. I mean, I don't know, six months, five months, something like that.
Yeah.
She was so fast that I wasn't able to cope with her, because she was sending me chapters and I was also at the same time writing another book. So I was like, please stop, I can't read. And before I was able to correct and send my feedback to her, she was sending me the other. She loved the book so much. And that's the most important thing about the translator, that they love. And at the end, she said, you know, I cried while I was translating it. And this is like, these people became like my children. And she was really connected to the characters, to the story. And I think that's what made the translation so beautiful.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Like, that's what you hope for in any reader. But, like, the fact that the translator, like, she like got that immersed in it, and she, like, it became, she cared that much about it too. And I think that definitely comes across, like, in the translation as well.
Absolutely. I'm so lucky to have found her.
Yeah. So how did you find her? Like, how did that, like, did you find her, like, on a job board or something?
No. I think I put a post on Facebook, or I was talking to a friend. I don't remember now, but I said, does anyone know a good Turkish English translator? And I made it very specific. It has to be literature. It has to be a native English speaker. Please don't come back to me saying that. I speak very good English. I speak very good English, but I'm not a translator. Okay. So, and I'm the writer of this book. I'm the author. But don't come to me and say, I can translate it. It has to be a native, either British or American native English speaker, and a very, very good Turkish speaker. And a friend of mine, she said, you know, there's this woman, she lives in a small island outside in the northern Aegean Sea of Turkey. She might be interested. She was a teacher in the American college for many, many years in Istanbul. So why don't you ask her? And I asked her and she said, send me the book, let me see. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. I mean, she was doing translations, but now she became a full-time translator thanks to my books.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's helped her finally make a little career jump.
I think so. And I'm very happy for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So now do you think like you're gonna, you know, if you have any other projects in mind, or you said you're working on another book, are you gonna go for English now? Like for, you know,
of course,
or at least English translations?
No, absolutely. I mean, now next year the title will be Around the Breakfast Table. It's already translated and ready to go. And now I'm writing another book that's kind of semi-historical fiction, semi-COVID times. So it's taking place today. It started in January 2020 and it's taking place in a building in Istanbul. So everybody is locked into the building. But we also have a history of Istanbul because the narrator is a 75-year-old male Greek. So he's telling us the history of Istanbul and what happened for the last 70 years to the city. And it's similar to the Silence of Shehrazad, where I tell the loss of a cosmopolitan city. Mm-hmm. Here again, we're talking about a loss of Istanbul, which was like, again, many languages, many religions together living until 1960s, 1970s, and how it became what it is today, a single language, a single ethnicity, a single religion. This new book is about how we lost Istanbul. Istanbul was a cosmopolitan town, beauty, many languages, many ethnicities, many religions living together side by side, just like Smyrna, even bigger than Smyrna. Today it's just another urban center with, you know, skyscrapers and corporate capitalism taking over, and it's looking just like another huge urban center in the world. And it's the story of how we lost the uniqueness of Istanbul.
Yeah. So you got kind of like in a niche there, like you did the Silence of Scheherazade with all like the research and the historical fiction. And now you're like, you wanted to do it again in another like part of the world with another point of view and all that.
Yes. I mean, this one is especially special for me because I am from Istanbul. Istanbul is my town. And I am watching how we are losing it day by day.
So I imagine that this next one coming up is obviously it's still close to your heart, but it's like it's even more so. That's really cool. I like that, you know, how you found your groove with this, and then you just like, you know, you got sucked into the process and like you're gonna do it again. I love it. So why did you decide to tell this story from Scheherazade's point of view, like first person, but her narrating or like an observer, you know, of the different other points of view?
Well, I actually tried to find the narrator for a long time. I played with the idea. Maybe 6 months, I wasn't sure who's going to be the narrator. It wasn't a decision at the first sight. I tried Avinash. I tried Gypsy Yasemin. I tried Scheherazade herself. I tried a narrator not related to any of the characters. So, and the name, okay. So Scheherazade is the name for us, the ones who grew up in the Middle East, is a very familiar name. Okay. She is the narrator of 1001 Nights, or known as the Arabian Nights. It's like the, you know, children's tales of our childhood. So we grew up As the children of Middle East, we grew up hearing the tales of Shehrazad. It's like the Decameron stories of Europe, or I don't know, Arthur
or like
King's
maybe like Grimm's
stories
fairy
in England.
tales in the US, I
Yeah,
think that
so
would be,
Shehrazad is
yeah.
it's a very familiar name. And what's up with Shehrazad is that she's required to tell a story every night. If not, she will be killed. That's her
Oh,
job.
okay.
So she has to come up with a good story for the terrible emperor not to kill her. And if she can stop the story in the middle and says, if you want to hear the rest of the story, you should let me live because otherwise you will not be able
Right.
to. Okay, so that's her trick. And the silence of Shehrazad means the death of Shehrazad in a way. So a Shehrazad can never be silenced if she wants to live. So I wanted to play with that idea.
Yeah.
And here I use the same name. She is the narrator of the tale, but she doesn't want to continue talking. She has actually buried herself into silence, which
Right.
is the symbol of like the things we don't talk about the past. There are so many secrets in every country, and Turkey is no exempt from that. Every country doesn't talk about certain things, and we
Yeah.
bury them in silence. And it means the death of those parts of history. So we kill some
Right.
parts of the history by remembering some, other parts. And now with the 21st century, what we see, everybody is actually waking up with the stories of the minorities, whatever that means. Like I have problems with the term minority, but like for the ease of communication, I will use that term because
Sure.
the majority tells one version of history, but there is many, many histories or her stories of the minorities. And now the silence of Shehrazad is broken. And we are all talking about alternative histories. And this book is an alternative history reading to the official history of Turkish Republic, which is all about victory and no loss and all that. Like
Right.
every country's official history is all about victory. There's never a loss. You never find loss in the official
Yeah.
histories. And this is an alternative reading to history. And
I
Shehrazad, a
love
silent
that.
Shehrazad is a, yeah.
No, I just so I, you know, just hearing about that, like the significance of the name and her, the like the traditional children's tale of her, of that certain storyteller. And now that like I know that, like, you know, because obviously like born and raised in America, I'm not gonna know those types of like things emerge like from the culture. And so now that I know that, like kind of it gives me like a little deeper meaning. Like I love that it's like, no, you're playing with the words, you're playing with the narrator. Like what if she went silent? Like what if she just said, no, I'm
Exactly,
done.
like.
But she's still kind of like, she's still telling stories, but it's like, she's telling the reader the stories, but anybody else who's interacting with her, she's just like, no, thank you. She's like, sorry, not sorry. It's like almost taking back some of that power because she knows everything, but she's not saying anything. And so that's so
Exactly.
cool.
That's the thing. That's a super good point because this is what we do. This is when we are silenced. It's exactly what we do. We know, but we don't talk about it. And that creates submission. And the moment you say, I know, and you're actually freeing yourself as minority groups or the silenced groups are freeing themselves, breaking free themselves by choosing not to be silent again. And this is like the basic premise of the book, like break free from your silence, because you are silenced by some power mechanisms. And now it's time to break that silence. So tell us your story is the message of the behind the silence of Shehrazad, because not to give any spoiler to our readers, but at the end, there's a chance our silent Shehrazad will speak.
Oh, awesome. I know. I'm like, oh, for real, spoiler free, because I'm like, I'm almost there. I'm excited to finish it though. This is kind of like a two-part question. What were like your favorite parts to write and like what were like the most challenging parts to write?
Beginning was very challenging, and I think for the reader, because it was challenging for me, for the reader, it's a bit challenging too. Like, setting was fun, but also challenging to have the setting of a historical. It was like walking in the dark, because mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about Smyrna. Let me remind you and our listeners that I am not from Izmir. I didn't know the modern version of the city also.
Right.
So
right.
It's like, you know some stuff about it, but right. you know, if you don't know how it feels, the air, the mountains and stuff like that. So the most challenging thing is imagining how it is to be there. And my obsession about the details to be very realistic was very challenging. Now I relax and I don't care that much anymore. It's actually like writing fiction is a free world. I don't have to be that obsessed. But like my own obsession was hard. I know, like at some point I was really obsessed about the electricity. What places had electricity and what places did not have electricity? And it was one of the hardest things to research. Like nobody knew. Okay, some hotels, they did have electricity. How about
that's
the homes?
Such a good
no,
point.
The homes didn't
yeah.
have electricity. How about water? What was the infrastructure for water? I know, right? Like you never think about those things. And then because it's early 20th century in the United States, most houses had electricity by then.
Sure.
How about in Istanbul, they had electricity, but how about in Smyrna? Anyway, I found out at the end. But like that took me, for 2 days I stopped writing until I find the answer to this question.
Oh, wow.
fun part, yeah. yeah, I was frozen and I was just researching that. So the whole story, the whole characters, the whole crew, the cast had to wait for me to find out that little bit.
Oh, like, yeah. How do you explain that? Like, no, I'm trying to answer one question.
Exactly. Like, let me find out if you guys have electricity in your houses or not.
Yeah.
One of the fun parts is actually the things I have brought from my own life. For example, there is a scene. It's the 1921 New Year's party. And I really enjoyed writing that. And I wanted to, you know, Russian novels like Anna Karenina, for example, that they have amazing party scenes. They have amazing ball scenes. And I wanted to write a New Year's party where most of my characters will come as either as hosts or guests or maids or this or that. But I wanted them to be all together in one magnificent party. That was fun to write, the New Year's party at the house of the Edward in Bournebat. And another fun thing was there's a scene, the teenagers are going to a festival by the sea, in full moon festival in a neighboring little village. And they have little food there. It's like that old school feeling of a festival out in the night. And just being a teenager, it doesn't make a difference which era you're writing. You know, if the boy you like touches your knee, you kind of feel the same, like no matter where are you and when are you living your life. So that was also a fun chapter. Ayatollahada, when they go for a full moon outing.
Yeah. I liked her as a character too, because it's you know, her like, you know, just like feeling so helplessly like smitten with this boy, and I just would be like, girl, just forget him, it's okay.
Like how important he is at that moment. Your heart beats, like when one little touch means a world to you.
Exactly. I love that. That's such a good point where you're, you know, where you're putting yourself back. You have to remember what it felt like to be a teenager and to feel like those exciting emotions and feelings and, you know, interactions and the effect that it had on you. And that's such a good point that it's like, it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in or what era you're in. A lot of that is universal and it transcends like time. And that's
exactly
such a good
point. And that's what I wanted to. And, you know, at the end, when she, Panayota, she is realizing that she's losing everything. There's a moment she realizes that she actually had the most precious life But as a teenager, she always thought, you know, happiness was somewhere else. Happiness was in the lives of the rich people in the big hotels and this and that. And then the moment she sees her house taking up into flames, she realizes that life, the ideal life, was actually there with his mom and dad and eating beans and sharing bread, or the touch of the boyfriend under the table. Mm-hmm. And that's what we all experience, actually. We think as a teenager, the real things we will live in the future. Only at a certain age, we turn and we look and we see, my God, like, we actually lived back then.
Yeah.
Because we were so open to feeling everything. Like, our bodies were fresh. We were feeling more. Our hearts were fresh. So the real life was actually back then. So in a way, it's a game. When you're young, you think it's going to come. When you're older, you think it's past.
Yeah.
And I wanted to give that.
Yeah. You know, almost like rose colored glasses. Like, you think, you know, the grass is greener type of thing, or, you know, you just
exactly.
think like,
oh, grass
like, I can't wait for my life to start. And it's just like, well, no, like, you're
oops.
Living it.
Yeah. Oops. It passed.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. I like to ask authors this all the time. So you have like your four main like characters / points of view or whatever. What advice would you give to each of those women that you focus on? We have like who?
Okay.
Edith, Panayota, Malina, and then
Sumbul. The Turkish,
Sumbul, yes.
The Turkish one, so, Sumbul. Okay, yeah. So with Edith, I would definitely, Edith, I recommend her to love, because she was, you know, she was pretty, she had everything, but she was in a way disabled in the heart. She wasn't able to love. She had a man who actually loved her so much, so opening her heart and loving. And let's leave Panayota at the end. Melina is not a like very prominent character, but she's there and she's like the mover of the plot. So we needed her so much. For her, like, just to forgive herself, because she was blaming herself for causing maybe the death of a baby. And actually, I would have advised her to look how the network of things work in a way.
Yeah.
You actually saved a life, and that person is has lived about 100 years and telling us a story. So forgive yourself.
Yeah.
And Sumbul was actually one of the, you know, the most innocent, the most naive, and unfortunately she commits suicide. And she's, what can I tell to her? Like, maybe just be free. And she had a moment, like, she liked another guy who was visiting their house, and maybe she wanted to have sex with her and enjoyed her body, like, just to give, instead of letting go of the moral norms in her head, just to enjoy her body, I would say.
Sure.
Just go with the guy. Your husband has been in the war for like 4 years and he's not coming back. You just go sleep with the guy for one night. It's okay. Life is too short anyway.
Yeah.
I think I would just encourage her in enjoying her own body. And Panayota, who is our main character, who's a teenager, and like, know your beauty. You know, life is what you are living right now as a teenager, and you will lose everything. So be there, be in the moment. This is your life and enjoy it.
Yeah, I know. And some of those stories, like with Sumbul, for example, is just like so heartbreaking. And it was crazy how, like, there were some parts where it's like, you know, you were almost kind of leading up to, like, oh, wait, their paths are crossing. It's like, before I knew it, like, oh, wait, it went. Like, wait, hold on. I got to think about that real quick. Yeah, I got to catch up.
Many times they cross paths. Like, either it goes to the house of Sumbul. So they kind of cross path. Panayota and Edith, they kind of see each other.
Yeah.
Many places they see each other, but of course they don't know their connection.
Yeah.
Avinash sees Panayota and thinks that she resembles someone so much, doesn't connect. But that, you know what happens, Megan? That gives us a power as the reader, because we have one card, one joker card extra in our hands. That's, we know the connections. We know something they don't know. And that makes us, that's the joy of reading. Yeah. You know more than your characters. So as a, like from my childhood onwards, I really enjoyed this aspect of being a reader. I know more than the characters, and it gives you a, like a godlike quality to the reader. You see things better than, like you see why things are happening that way while the characters are crying. Like, why is this happening to me? From the seat, which is higher, you see why it's happening. That has to happen for this, the other end of the room, something else is happening. Right. You know, the, like the butterfly effect. This, you have to go through this pain for so that the other baby could be born.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, like it's like heartbreaking, but it's kind of like, that's like fun, but it's almost like,
That's not fun for the characters, but it's, I'm not going to say fun, but it's pleasure of reading.
Yeah.
You know, we know that, you know, what's pleasurable in a way, like guilty pleasure, but it's there. You see the inevitability of the things. Things will happen the way they happen because like the whole plot is designed that way. So then I look at life, not fiction. I look at life whenever I'm like one of my characters. Why is this happening to me? It's kind of an eye-opening moment for me. Maybe it's a plot. Like this whole life is a plot. We are in a novel and we are in a fiction. And for me, I have to go through this trouble for something else to take place in the plot. So I sometimes see life, have a tendency to think that my life is a fiction. Everybody's life is a fiction.
Or you just
Why
get
not?
Ideas for more stories, right?
Yeah, that's true also. But the inevitability, like this had to happen. It's inevitable. It gives you like it also makes your creative muscles work as a reader again, not as an author, as a reader. You keep talking and thinking during the day, what if she did it that way? What if she didn't go there? But it's like, no, the book is written. It's set in stone. But you're still thinking creatively. So the reader is writing half of the book while reading it. That's what they say with her imagination.
I like that. I like that take on it. Just to kind of like wonder, you know, your brain can't help but kind of like explore other possibilities.
And that's where the stories come from. That's where you start. You know, this book is actually coming from a very similar exercise that I was doing when I was reading the novel called Middlesex. I don't know if you heard about it. Middlesex is written by Jeffrey Eugenides. It's an American, Greek-American author from Detroit. And he has a book called Middlesex. And Middlesex begins in Smyrna. And then it continues in Detroit. But when I read Middlesex, I was just thinking, what if they stayed in Smyrna? What if it was like continuing a little bit more in that time? What if, you know, blah, blah, blah. So with that mental exercise, I happened to write The Silence of Scheherazade. So maybe from The Silence of Scheherazade, somebody else will write another book.
Yeah, exactly. You never know. We're going to wrap up here. This was so cool. So enjoyable. I'm like, as long as I've got my to-do list today, but as soon as I'm done with that, I'm going to finish the book. The plan. Cool. I want to finish it.
Please let me know. Yeah. The last chapter is once you know, like there is no more secrets, you know, the plot, you know, who is who. And now it's for you to just to enjoy the scenes.
Right. Yeah. That's what I like about like how, but that's how so many books are, where it's like the, you know, the first half or whatever is really just like laying the groundwork, especially when you're like, telling the story from different points of view. You gotta make sure everything is good to go and understood and familiar with the reader. Yes. And then like the, you know, the juicy parts can come, and then that the reader's not distracted by learning still, like they're ready to go forward, like, you know, keep the ball rolling. And so that's where I'm right now. Like I'm right where Edith had just welcomed like so many refugees into her garden, and and I thought that was so interesting that she it's almost like she like she switched, like something's turned on in her, something switched in her personality almost, where she finally was like she couldn't say no, and
like, this is her she found her purpose in life. It's helping people, and she never realized that. So, like for the first time, Edith is happy because she has a purpose. You know, as a rich girl, she never had a purpose. And now she does.
I really appreciate that. No, I love that. I'm like that's where I am right now. I'm just like, oh my god. Like, and then I was like, oh my god, I like, I gotta start the interview soon. So I was like, so I'm like right in the, you know, right in the thick of the emotional parts of it, and then it's really gonna start, you know, rolling.
That's what's gonna happen.
Just real quickly, I'm curious about the cover. Did you like pick out the cover, or, you know, how much say did you have in that? Because it's interesting. It's kind of like, it's really ambiguous, but it's like really pretty.
It's really pretty. I think here's what happened. It's a cover. I don't have the Turkish one. I was going to show you the Turkish one. Anyway, so it's the British publisher who came up with the cover. And I really liked it. And I think it's inspired by a little video my Greek publisher made when they were publishing The Silence of Shehrazad. They made a tiny video on YouTube. And there is an image there, Shehrazad, turning like a dervish. And I think the British publisher saw the video and kind of used that kind of turning, whirling dervish image of Shehrazad on the cover. So I really liked it because it's a collaboration of the Turkish, Greek, and British editions of the book together in one cover. I didn't say anything. They showed me. I said, it's amazing. Just go for it. I accepted it right away.
That's awesome. Yeah, because I know, like, when I talk to other authors about, you know, because sometimes they have a say in it, sometimes they have no say, sometimes they have the illusion of having, you know, feedback or whatever. But that's really cool that you were like, no, this is great. Like,
I really liked it. Normally, if I don't like it, I always say things, make this bigger, change the color. But with this one, I was very happy from the first moment. So I said, let's go with that. And I actually built an entire website on the basis of this cover. Like, I like the images and the colors so much. Now my whole website is based on the same design. It's my name, www.defnesuman.com.
Okay. Yeah, we'll include it when we post the interview. We'll include it in, like, the show notes.
It's just my name, last name.com, all together, defnesuman.com. Yeah.
Awesome. And then are you like on Twitter and Instagram and stuff?
I am, all of them. And when you go to the website, you're going to find all those social media and links are there.
Okay. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. We'll make sure to include all those good links. So thank you so much, Daphne. This was so cool.
That was so cool.
Yeah. Silence of Shahrazad. It's out now. Go get it, especially for historical fiction people. For people who I think just like in general are curious about maybe lesser known historical events, or at least from this point of view, I'm sure in your part
maybe
of the
European
world,
European history. Are interested in European history, First World War times.
Yeah. Or just like female protagonists, you know,
That's another thing. Yeah. Story, not history.
Exactly.
People who are into her story.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to keep an eye out for, you know, other stories and other English translations that you've got coming up.
Thank you so much.